First, what I want to do today is to discuss the relation between perturbation theory which is an expansion in powers of the coupling constant and what's called the topology of the diagrams, namely why it's an expansion, it's called the loop expansion, an expansion in the number of loops inside each diagram. That's what I promised yesterday. And then after that, I'm going to discuss the important concept of irreducible diagrams. Which I discussed a bit last time, and its relation with the concept of the quantum effective action, which is the generating functional for irreducible diagram, but which is also an object which has a physical significance. And it's important both in quantum field theory and in statistical mechanics. So you probably have met it already in statistical mechanics under a slightly different name. Okay, so first, perturbation theory. So remember that we were dealing with a phi-4 theory, but what I'm going to discuss here is more general. So the phi-4 theory means that you have the Feynman rules as that. You have a propagator, and there is a factor h bar associated to each propagator, as we have seen. And we have the vertices, the internal vertices. This is the propagator. We have the internal vertices, and they have a factor g divided by h bar in perturbation theory. Okay? And what we are considering is the amplitudes generated by the generating functional. So remember, we had z of g, which is the generating functional for all the diagrams. So it's integral d phi exponential of minus 1 over h bar s of phi. Again, I'm using the Euclidean formalism in order to have annoying I factors, but that's, I'm discussing just the combinatorics and the terms of h bar, so it doesn't mind whether you are in Euclidean or in real-time formalism, okay? And we define a generating functional for the connected diagram, which is just h bar times the log of z of g. Okay, and I'm going to concentrate on this functional, which, as we have seen, is a generating functional for connected diagrams. Connected diagrams and connected.
Why do we need this factor of h bar?
Well, it's for convenience, of course. You can, but you'll see. You'll see why it's useful. Okay. It's just a convention which is used. Okay. And so you see, well, basically, this means that this object is, when you expand it in powers of g's, you know, it has different g's. So when you have this, you have some factor which has of the form. Oh, and of course, I'm sorry, I forgot a very important term that I have here, g times phi. Here. So you see that this functional generates all the diagrams, and you obtain correlation function of phi by taking derivative with respect to g. But each derivative with respect to g gets a 1 over h bar on the denominator. So it means that these terms generate the external vertices of the diagrams. So you have the external vertices, you see. You have an external vertices. Okay, and each external vertices is associated to a phi at a given point, z. But so each external vertices contains a factor g divided by h bar. So if x is a point here and it is a coordinate here, it's g of z times h bar. Well, here, this is the internal vertices associated to the phi 4 of x. So you see, with this normalization, there is a 1 over h bar associated to each external vertices. It's just a it follows from the definition, and you will see why it's convenient. Okay, so it means that when now you compute this, you get a sum over connected diagrams. Okay, so here you have a connected diagrams. And let's assume that this connected diagram, and then assume that this connected diagram has n external vertices. K internal vertices. Okay. To this diagram, of course, are associated n factor of g divided by h bar. So this is a term, and k internal vertices with factor of g to the power h bar. And then you have some propagator. So the amplitude of this diagram, it contains n factor of g, the power of the Copley constant to the power k, a product of propagator, so an amplitude, an integral of a product of the Green's function, and then you have some power of h bar. So which power of how many h bar do you have? Well, it's simple. You have some power of h bar. Well, you have minus n power of h bar, which comes from the external vertices, minus k power of h bar coming from the internal vertices. Then you have plus some power of h bar, which comes from the number of propagators. So let's call L the number of lines of the graph. You have a Feynman diagram, so a graph G here. A graph G, so this is the number of lines of the graph. Okay, and of course, this is minus n plus k. So n plus k is v, which is a number of vertices of the graph. That's a total number of vertices. You have internal vertices and you have external vertices. Okay? And then, in addition, you have plus one, because Feynman rules give this, but you multiply this log of z, which is the sum of diagrams, by h bar. So you have plus one. Okay. And this one here, in fact, turns out to be, let's call it c. This is a number of connected components of the graph. And remember, we are dealing with the generating function for connected diagrams. Of course, there is only h. So this number c is one. Okay. So this is the power. So the power of h bar is, let's assume we get h bar to a simple number, which is L plus C minus V. With those definitions, L is the number of lines of the graph, V is the number of vertices of the graph, C is the number of connected component of the graph. Now, there is a very famous theorem, which is goes back to Euler and then to many Euler, Kirchhoff, Poincaré, the more general sense, etc., etc. So it's associated to dimension, which tells that this number, L plus C minus V, is equal to a number, let me call it B. B is for boucle in French, so I like big mean loop, which is a number of internal loops of the graph. Okay. And the number of internal loops means the number of independent cycles of the graph. And well, what does it mean? That simply is the number, when you have a graph, it can be a graph with no cycles. Then it's a tree. It's a tree. For instance, consider this is a tree, this is a tree, this is a tree, this is a tree. I'm dealing with general graph. I don't care whether they are graph of the FIFO theory or abstract graph. So these are examples of tree of graphs where B equals zero. And you can check that 1 plus 1 minus 2 equals zero. And if you start from a simple tree, each time that you had a line, you had a vertex, and you junction, you do not change the number of connected components, so B doesn't change. And by the way, a single vertex is a tree, because 0 plus 1 minus 1 equals 0. Okay, so those are trees. Now, if you start to add to a tree a line without, so take this object. Add a line of this one, add a line without adding a vertex, etc. Then you have B equal 1, because we have added a line without changing those numbers. So those are, and you see that those are graphs with one cycles. If you want, if you view these as electric circuits or circuits where some liquid can flow, then you can have an independent, you can have some flow with arbitrary intensity, some current with arbitrary intensity flowing through this. Okay, so these are one loop graphs. Okay, etc. This graph, or this graph, etc., have B equal 2, so they have 2 independent cycles. So for instance, you can take this to be a cycles, this to be cycles, and then the third obvious cycle they can draw is not independent of those ones. If you know which current flow there and which current flow there, by the law of additivity of currents, you know what flow there. So this is B equal 2. These are 2 loops graphs. Okay? So you see that perturbation theory can be reorganized as a series expansion in power of h bar. And the higher the number of loops, the smaller the power of h bar is. Okay? And that's very general. That's something which is valid for any quantum field theory, because I've not considered whether the diagrams are diagram of Phi-4 or diagram of quantum electrodynamics or diagram of some theory with fermions or diagram of Young-Mills, etc.
When would C not equal 1?
What?
When would C not equal 1?
When? Why?
Either.
Pardon?
Would you get C not equal to 1?
If C is not equal to 1? Well, then that is just a general, it's a more general definition. But then if you consider a disconnected diagram like this one, let's consider this diagram times this diagram. Well, this is just add up. So this number of loop of a disconnected diagram is just the sum of the number of loops of each connected component. So it's a simple generalization. So this is not specific to. Equal 1. Okay, so.
Sorry, what would be the C over there? Like,
pardon?
What would be the C for that diagram?
Well, this one is. This C is 2. It has 2 connected components.
Okay.
Number of V is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Number of line is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. No, V is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
That's correct.
So does it work?
Yes, it does.
And the number?
V equals 1.
Yeah.
Plus 5 minus
6 is 1. I made a mistake because then I should have. No, that's okay. And then the number of loops is 1. Yes, which is 1 here. So you see.
So. What does this diagram contribute to whom does it?
Pardon?
So this is not connected diagram. So is this a contribution to ZJ, the pattern function?
So this is going to be a contribution to Z of G.
But
in Z of G, you are going to have you have divided by H of C. So in yes. Z of G is expanded. You can expand them, but then you don't have this term.
Yes, we have a digital H bar to the
So that's why it's I prefer to deal with that.
Okay.
Of course. Okay. But the mathematical definition of this number of internal loop of a graph is not specific to connected diagrams. Okay. Here it's a math. Okay. And finally, if you are inclined with mathematics, this number B of a graph, in mathematics, this is called B1. This is called the first Betti number of the graph, where the graph is considered as an ensemble of vertices and lines, so it's called what is called a one-dimensional simplicial complex. So I won't elaborate on that, but there is a whole mathematical definition of this number of loops, which is much more general, which applies to objects, which are, so there are generalizations. So you have generalization where you have a number bn, where n can be 0, 1, 2, 3, to general simplicial complexes. So objects that you construct built out of points, segments, triangles, tetrahedra, etc. So it applies to general simplicial complex, which are called in the literature also CW complexes. Okay, so there is a whole mathematical theory which is related to homology theory. So, okay. But let's just keep discussing graphs.
So this particular way of like categorizing diagrams based on number of loops.
Pardon? Yes.
This way.
Yes.
Will it work for a lattice theory? For example, if I have like some sort of expansion on a lattice.
You mean a high temperature on a lattice?
Sure.
I don't know if it's really useful, but maybe. I'm not sure.
But so. One can categorize diagrams in that.
I'm sure, because it's a very general. Yes. Okay. So let me finish by the discussion, yes, of this point, by showing that for phi 4 theory, the expansion in H bar is the same thing that the expansion in G, in the coupling constant. Let me show that. This was very specific. So now let's go to phi 4 for phi 4 diagrams, like for instance, this one. This one, but then you have higher dimensional diagrams. So this is a tree, this is a one loop diagram, this is a two loop diagram. Well, these are also two loop diagram, things that we have generated, etc. For phi 4, you have an additional relation which uses just the fact that a segment has two endpoints. That's obvious, but that's an important result. A segment has two endpoints. And therefore, if you consider each propagator in a graph, this is a propagator. Each propagator has two endpoints. So let's consider this is a number of endpoints for each propagator. Either the endpoint is an external endpoint, or it's one of the four endpoints legs of an internal vertices. So you have this relation, 2L is equal to the number of external vertices, N plus 4 times the number of internal vertices. And that's specific to phi 4 here. If it was phi 3, it would be different. If it was a phi 3 theory with a phi 3 term, it would be 3. This comes from phi 4. Okay. And so this means simply that L, N, and K are not independent. So you plug this relation into the definition of B, and you end up into the fact that B equal 1 minus n divided by 2 plus k. Number of internal vertices, number of external vertices. And you can check that. This has 4 external vertices, 1 internal vertices, so b equals 0. This has b equal 1, etc. And so you see that each term, each diagram, a diagram with n external legs, a connected diagram, has a factor h bar to the power 1 minus n divided by 2 times h bar times g to the power k. So you have some factor of h bar that depends on the number of legs, which comes from this fact here. And then each time that you had a vertex, you had an h bar. So expansion in h bar is the same thing that an expansion in the coupling constant G for 5 to the 4. So that's why one refers often to the perturbative expansion in the coupling constant as a loop expansion, an expansion in the loop. Well, that's specific for phi 4, because the vertex is G. If you are adding with, for instance, QED, the vertex, the interaction vertex is like this one. And it contains the E factor, That's the charge of the electron. That's the coupling constant. Then, for QED, the expansion in H bar turns out to be expansion in E squared, which is a fine structure constant. So here, the number of loops is not proportional to the number of internal vertices. You have to add two internal vertices to get one factor of H bar. So it depends on the theory. Okay. And finally, you see that since the number of loops indicates the number of H bar factors in the theory, the factor H bar goes to zero gives three diagrams. But setting H bar to zero in the theory means you are dealing with a classical limit theory. H bar one gives one loop diagram, so it's the first quantum correction. So that's called the leading quantum corrections. So if you are in a problem where quantum effects are small, considering one loop diagram is enough. And then etc. If you are in a problem which is strongly non-quantum, then you have to consider a large number of terms of the perturbation theory of the loop extension and resum them. But if the system is a semi-classical regime, then one loop calculations are enough. Okay? Yes?
Could there be a theory where the power of H bar and the power of the coupling constant are of opposite signs, which would be?
I don't think so, because this would mean that the quantum effects are small when H bar is very large, when the coupling is very large. So it means that you are considering the theory from the wrong side, if you want. You have to change variable and consider that and look whether what's happening for the theory where it is strongly coupled. So find an equivalent theory which is weakly coupled when the coupling constant of the original theory is large. So that's feasible in many interesting cases because it's a kind of finding theory which are dual to each other. Okay, so now let me go back to what's called the effective action. Okay, so first let me go back to what. Remember that yesterday, when I showed a bunch of diagrams, I showed that an interesting part of the diagrams are called the irreducible diagram. For instance, a single vertex in a diagram like that is irreducible diagram. This diagram, this subdiagram, is irreducible. This diagram is irreducible. This diagram, this subdiagram is irreducible. You see? So, in fact, what they are called is they are one particle irreducible, or one PI. That's the standard denomination. What does it mean? A graph, a connected graph, is one particle irreducible if, when you cut any of its lines, it's still connected. So, connected, cut a line, imply. Still connected. So you see, if we cut this line, you end up with this one, which is connected. If you cut this line, take this one. Cut this, you get this, which is connected, still connected, but not irreducible anymore. If you cut this line, it's not connected, etc. And of course, this diagram, for instance, if you get this line, you get two connected parts. So it's not one particle irreducible. Okay. So can we deal simply with those irreducible diagram, because they are basically the building blocks blocks of perturbation theory. Well, the quantum effective action is going to be the generating functional for those building blocks. So I'm first going to give formal definition of the quantum effective action, and then I'll show you why it's a generating functional for those building blocks, which are the one particle irreducible diagram. Okay, so let's start from the generating functional for the connected diagram, which is defined here. Okay. So G is a source term. So it's an external field. Let's consider what's happening when you take W of G and you take its functional derivative with respect when you vary the source term at a given point X, but you do not fix, so we take a functional derivative but do not set G to zero at the end. Then you get an object which is a functional of G. So you get a field, let's go call it phi of X, but that's var phi in tech notation, so that's one of the Greek version of the letter phi. So it's a function of X. So it's a function. So it's a function of X, but it is also a functional of G. So if you change the value of G, this function of X changes. And when you set G equals to zero, you get the expectation value of the quantum field phi in the ground state of the series. Okay, but so you can view this as the expectation value of the quantum field phi of the series when you keep the external field, the source term, the source field non-zero. So basically, this is the expectation value of phi for the series with action S of phi minus G times phi. So you change the action, so of course the vacuum expectation value of the theory is different. The theory with this action has a different ground state than the theory with just S. So the expectation value of the field operator phi is different, and it's a functional of this term. Okay. So this object phi of X, which is in fact, you should remember it, that it is a functional of G, is called phi of X. So it's a field phi, it's called the background field. It's the expectation value of a quantum field for a quantum theory that depends on G. So this background field is, of course, different from the source field, which is classical. So this is a vacuum expectation value of a quantum field. So it's very different from G, because G is a classical external source classical field. Okay. Yes?
Are you saying here phi is the background field?
Yeah, phi here is defined. This object is called the background field. Okay, that's the standard denomination for it. Okay, so it's a background field of the theory, and it depends on the source field. So phi, in some sense, is a response. Phi is a response of the quantum theory to G. You apply an external source term. The response of the quantum theory is given by the background field phi. Okay. Okay, so now, in fact, what's interesting in many problems is that, and there are physical problems where you don't know what is the source terms, you don't know exactly what is the action of the theory, but you have information about the properties of the vacuum. So you have information about this. So you may ask, instead of considering that phi depends on G, so phi is given by G, can we do the inverse? Can we consider what's happening if we know phi and we want to know transfer? So can we consider G as a functional of phi? In other words, can we consider how the theory depends on the response field? And that's something which is done very often in physics. That's what is done in thermodynamics. In thermodynamics, you have a system, you have a gas contained in a fixed volume. When you vary the volume, the change in the internal energy is a pressure. So the pressure is the response of the system to change in the volume. Okay. And if you want to consider the property of a gas as a function of its pressure instead of its volume, then instead of considering the energy of the system, you have to consider another thermodynamical function, which is called, if I'm not mistaken, the enthalpy.
Huh? Sorry?
The enthalpy. Enthalpy. The enthalpy. 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 So in thermodynamics, you have internal energy of V, and you go to the enthalpy of P. Okay. In the same way, if you consider the energy, the internal energy, as a function of the temperature, and you want to see what is the response of the system when you change the temperature, that's the entropy. So the variable is a free, the change, the due quantity is a free energy. So that's a free energy. But this is the enthalpy. Okay. So that's exactly what we are going to do here for a quantum field theory.
So it's a Legendre transformation.
So we are going to do what's called Legendre formation. Okay, let me go there. So, yes?
W would be the equivalent of free energy.
Yes, so W is equivalent, in fact, W is equivalent to minus the free energy. So there is a minus sign.
Right.
Yeah. So, no, let me, okay. So what is the definition of the effective action? I start from W of G. So let me, I start from W of G. I defined phi of phi as the functional derivative of W with respect to G. And here G is a field, so this means that phi depends on x, and that's the functional derivative of W with respect to G of x. So the, this is just a compact notation for this. Compact notation. Notation. And I define its Legendre its forms as follows. I define an object that I call capital gamma. That's the standard denomination, which depend on the background field phi. It's a functional of the background phi. And this is simply the products of G with phi minus W of G. There's a minus because it's minus the free energy. Where now I consider that G considered as phi. Okay. And again, this is a compact notation for g dot phi equal integral over gx on space of g of x times phi of x, where his phi is a functional of g. So you invert that and you consider that g is a functional of phi. So it's an unknown function. Okay. And well, you see that this Legendre transform is involutive. So you can write equivalently that W of G is G times phi minus gamma of phi. Okay. So one of the interesting properties, the most interesting, well, this Legendre transform, so this Legendre transform is what is called the quantum effective action. Okay? Yes?
Can you explain how J is a functional of phi again?
This is formal. Phi here is a function of G. So you can just consider that you make a change variable. Instead of considering that phi, well, var phi here is a function of phi, you just change a variable. You consider phi as a function and g as a function, which depend on the value of var phi, the background field, at any point of x. So g is a functional of phi. It's just a change of variable. It's a bit, you have to do a bit. Imagine that imagine that you had a system discretized on a lattice with a finite number of points x. So the value of g at each point is a vector. The value of phi at those points is another vector. So you have a set of variables. Finite number set of variables. You have another. You make a change of variables, and you can invert that. So it's just a standard change of variables. he said if you have some vector x equal xi and you have a function y of x, which means that you have some function yi, which are some function yi of x1, xn, then you can consider that the y equal yy, yn are functions of x, namely that each yy is a function. You may consider that y is a function of x. You may consider that x is a function of y. So each xi is a function of y1, yn. Yes?
Assumes that the map is invertible.
Of course, we assume, big assumption. The mapping between phi and g is invertible, which is a very strong assumption. So I will show that this is reasonable in perturbation theory. If you are close to the classical vacuum. But that you are right, that's a highly non-trivial assumption. And when it's wrong, it means that there is some physical phenomenon, like typically some symmetry breaking. Okay. So I gave the definition. So let me just give two very important properties, which are in fact properties of the Legendre transform. So two properties. Property one. The vacuum expectation value of the quantum field phi in the real vacuum of the theory when g equals zero. So this is the vacuum expectation value of phi, the quantum field, phi hat, in the real vacuum of the theory with g equals zero. Yes?
What does VEV mean?
Pardon? When expectation value. VEV, if you have never seen that, means vacuum expectation value. Okay. So this, in fact, is equal to the value of the background field phi of x, some specific value of phi of x, let me call it phi zero, at the minimum of gamma of phi. So you have some function which gamma, this quantum effective action, which is a functional of phi. There is a configuration of the field where it takes its minimal value. This minimal value, which is a function of x, is just a function which gives a dependency in x of the quantum field phi in the vacuum of the original theory. So in other words, the quantum vacuum zero of the original theory, well, let's call it omega because it's an interacting theory, is more or less equivalent to the classical ground state of the theory with action gamma of phi. So you can view gamma of phi, the quantum effective action, as some complicated classical action for a classical field, which is a background field. And when it's minimized, you obtain the quantum vacuum of the original quantum theory. And that's a very general property. It just follows from Legendre transform. property two, if you consider the second derivative of phi at phi zero, so it's the Hessian, what you obtain is, and you take its inverse, I'm going to explain that. What you obtained is a two-point function of the original theory. So you obtain the propagator. So what does it mean? This of phi is just the kernel of an operator. It's a second derivative. It depends on indices. So this is just delta gamma of phi when you vary phi at point x, and then you take a second derivative at point phi of y. So you obtain a kernel. Okay? K of x and y.
Could you explain the first part?
The first part is that if I look for the minimum of the effective action at phi, it's a function, I get the expectation value of the quantum action, of phi, of the quantum field in the original theory. I'm going to prove that at leading order. OK. So you obtain some kernel. You consider the inverse kernel, k minus 1 of xy, which is defined by the fact that k minus 1 of xy times k of yz is delta of xz when you integrate over y. This means the definition. And what you get is that this inverse kernel, k minus 1, of xy is just equal to the propagator of the interacting theory. So the theory when z equals zero. So in some sense, the second derivative of gamma gives you the full two-point function of the quantum theory. So you see, the effective action contains a lot of information about the quantum theory. In fact, it contains all the information about the quantum theory. And again, this is a property of the Legendre transform. Okay? So it's true also for those objects, it's also true in thermodynamics. When you take second derivative, for instance, of the enthalpy with respect to the pressure, you get some, you get some susceptibility or compressibility. And here you get the compressibility of the system. Here you get the thermal susceptibility or latent heat, etc. So this kind of relation are very general. Okay, let's do the 5 minute break and resume in 5 minutes. Yes?
How do I understand that the quantum vacuum is classical vacuum of the theory of action?
Well, that's a fact, that's a result. That's a property of the Legendre.
Okay.
So you get a complicated classical theory. It's very complicated, it's non-local.
Okay.
It turns out to be non-local. But its minimum is the vacuum of the classic of the quantum theory. It's a mathematical property, which is very useful when you do calculation. But it's something non-local because you have transformed a complicated problem, a complicated quantum theory out of a simple classical action into a complicated classical theory which has a highly non-local classical action, which is this quantum effective actions. So you have not, you have just transformed a complicated problem, but quantum into a complicated problem, but formulated in a classical way. But that's very useful for some calculation. Okay?
The quantum vacuum here is the interacting vacuum.
Yeah, that's of course the interacting vacuum of the theory, because here I have not specified at all which theory we are dealing with. Here I have an action S of phi, and it is going to be the action of the interacting phi 4 theory. So everything defined here is very general. It's independent on the quantum theory. Okay. Well, a classical vacuum is that if you have a theory with an action, you look for the configuration of the variable of the field, which minimizes the action, and that's the ground state of the theory. So consider that the ground state of the state of rest, the state where the energy is minimized, of the action is minimized. You can view it as a classical vacuum. It's just the state with minimal energy. What I want to show you here is that in fact, I'm not sure I will have time this lecture, that to show why and how the effective action is the generating functional for those irreducible functions. And so what I'm going to show, I'm going to start to show what the power of functional integrals. Okay, so let's go back to the phi 4 theory. I consider S of phi is one half, it's integral over d dx, one half of d mu phi squared plus m squared over 2 phi squared minus g divided by phi 4 phi to the 4. Well, here I introduce the second derivative of functional, but you may ask, what is the second derivative? Well, what is first the first derivative of phi? So it is just the functional derivative of S of phi when you vary phi at a given point x. So S prime of phi at a given point x is just this. Well, you apply functional derivative, what you get is this, that this is minus nabla of phi at the point x, or nabla of phi at point x, plus m squared over 2 phi of x minus g divided by 3 phi 3 of x. You see? So this is the first order derivative. What is the second order derivative of phi? It's delta of s of phi divided by delta of phi of point x, delta of phi at point y. So you have to take the functional derivative of this. So of course, this is non-zero only if y is equal to x. So this is, in fact, when you take the derivative here, you have an operator. So in fact, this thing is going to be an operator. This is going to be the operator minus lambda. Here I take the second derivative of x, I just get m squared over 2. So plus m squared divided 2 times the operator identity. And here I get minus, this is a plus, I'm sorry. This is a plus g divided by 2, phi squared at point x. You know, and this is applied to the distribution delta of x minus y, where this is a Dirac distribution. So in fact, you see, this is an operator. Okay? Yes?
When we derive the first line, we derive the phi squared. Shouldn't there be a magnitude that
is in that? Well, I have a phi squared here.
That's in the term n squared, phi squared over 2?
No, the m squared has just.
It cancels the factor of 2.
The first action has phi squared when you derive it.
This term? No, I'm sorry. I don't understand your question.
The power of 2 should cancel.
Ah, yes, yes, yes. I'm sorry. Yes. It's a typo. But yeah, thank you very much. Yes, of course. Yeah, that's it. I should have looked at my notes. OK, so you see, what we call the second derivative of the action C, it's called the Hessian operator. We can write it as the operator minus delta plus m squared times the identity plus g over 2 times the multiplication by the function phi squared times the identity. So that's an operator. And the action of this operator on a given function is that when you take this operator, which depends on phi, and you apply it to some arbitrary function f, and you take the value of this at a given point x, what you get is minus nabla f of x plus m squared f of x, that's the Laplacian, plus g over 2 phi squared of x times f of x. So we see. So this is an operator that takes the function f and gives a function g, which I denote the operator second derivative of s applied to f. And you see, so it's a linear operator in F. It's a linear operator. But this operator depends on phi in a non-linear way. So it's a linear operator, but it is a functional of phi. OK. So this, we have an operator which is a functional of phi. So if you have an operator, well, you can see, check very easily that this operator is Hermitian. It's symmetric, so it's Hermitian. So it has eigenvalues, so you can manipulate this operator as matrices. So in particular, up to some, well, subtlety, you can define, you can consider its determinant of this operator. Okay? So you can consider formally what is the log of the determinant of this operator S double prime, which is a functional of phi. Okay? We have the determinant of a differential operator, the product of its eigenvalues, and we take the log, which is the sum of the log of the eigenvalues. So you can write this as the trace of an operator which is defined as the log of this operator. And think about it just as a generalization of what's happening for matrices. For matrices, generalization of matrices, where the determinant is the sum, is the product of the eigenvalues, and the trace is the sum of the eigenvalues. OK. Well, then we have a very nice result, which is that, let's call it the theorem, which is the quantum effective action, which is a functional of the background field phi. Well, you can expand it in H bar. Because it's going to be a calculation we do in perturbation theory. Well, it turns out that at leading order, or at classical order, the effective action is just the classical action of the theory. Then there is at order h bar zero, so classical h bar zero, at one loop order, there is a first quantum correction, and the quantum correction is just the trace precisely this subject, but evaluated, of course, in function of the background field. Okay? And then you have a higher order terms, which are slightly more complicated. But you have this very important formula, which is very compact. For a classic, well, when you set h bar to zero in your quantum theory, the quantum effective action reduces to the classical action. When you consider the first order h bar term, which corresponds to a one loop diagram, what you get as a correction is a trace of the logarithm of the second derivative of the classical action. In other words, the log of the determinant of the second derivative of the classical action. And it turns out that this gives precisely the contribution of all irreducible, so one particle, irreducible diagrams of the theory. Okay. And that's a very general, very general. In fact, this kind of formula is valid for any quantum field theory, not only a theory involving a scalar field like the 5-4 theory, but it's valid for theory with fermions up to a small modification, gauge field, and even the gravitational field. Yes?
So we're evaluating the classical action, but with the like the source term solution, right, of phi?
The source term has disappeared here because we re-express the source term as a functional of phi.
Right, right. So phi is a function of the source term.
So this is valid for any phi, any value of the background field. So it's very general. Basically, any action, S, and any value of the background field phi. So for instance, if you are interested in what is the expectation value of the quantum operator phi in the quantum theory, you look for the minimum of this quantity, and there will be the minimum of this, which is the classical minimum of the action, plus a correction that comes from that. You see? So you are going to get the correction of order h bar to the minimum of the classical action by minimizing this functional.
And I think you said this earlier, but why is the first functional derivative zero? Why is the first functional derivative of S zero?
I'm going to compute that.
Oh.
You want to see? So I can either show explicitly how it works for FI4 or give a general proof. Maybe I have time for only one of two. So maybe I'll start by giving the general proof, although it, it's still going to be a bit abstract. Okay. Okay, so let's prove this. Proof of the theorem. Proof of the theorem. Okay. Okay. I start from z of g, which is integral d phi exponential minus 1 over h bar, the classical action, minus g times phi. Okay. And since I want to do an small h bar expansion, I will use the saddle point approximation, which means that I look for the minimum of S of phi minus G times phi. Let me call it phi C. And it's a functional of G. It's a minimum in the space of function, which is a function of, so it's a classical function. Function. Which is a functional of the source term. Okay. And then expand phi as phi classical plus square root of h bar times some fluctuation, f phi tilde. And then integrate over the fluctuations. So integrate over the quantum fluctuation in the Gaussian approximation. Let me see what this means. Okay? So first, in order to do that, I have to look for the classical minima of this, which means, so the classical equation of motion, it's simply that S prime of phi C is equal to G, where S prime is the first order derivative of the classical action. Okay? So this defines phi C, and you see that it depends on G. So it's a classical solution of this equal G. So it's a classical solution of a nonlinear, of a quartic differential equation equals the source term. Okay. So this is the equation which defines phi C. Okay? Then, so this is the first step. Second step, I expand S of phi minus G phi. So I write as S of phi minus G times phi. I write it as S of phi C plus square root of h bar. I'll see how why you put an h bar times phi tilde minus g phi c plus h bar phi tilde. I just made a change of variable. Now I expand this around phi c. So I write this as this s of phi c plus the first derivative, so plus square root of h bar S prime of phi c, well, which is a function of x times phi tilde of x. So it's a function times a function integrated over x. So it's just a compact notation for the scalar products of two functions. One function is a functional of g, and this is just something you integrate over. And then second order derivative, I get h bar divided by 2 times the second derivative of the classical action evaluated at the saddle point. This is the saddle point. So phi c is the equation saddle point of s minus g phi. Okay, times, but then it's a term which is over the 2 in phi tilde. So in fact, this is an operator, so it gives a quadratic form. So you get phi tilde. So you have an operator acting on phi tilde. It gives another function, and I take the scalar product of this function with this function. So it's a quadratic form in phi tilde. And then, of course, I get higher order term of order h bar 3 half. But I'm interested in the term of order h bar. So I forgot those. Okay, so this is the first term. And then I get minus g minus g by c plus, there is the square root of h bar, I'm sorry, plus times g minus square root of h bar g times phi tilde. And that's it. That's exact. There are no corrections. Now, you see that the linear term in phi tilde and this term plus this terms equals zero, simply because of the saddle point equation. This is S prime of phi c minus g times phi tilde. So this is zero automatically. That's what the saddle point is good for. So we get that S of phi minus g phi can be written as S of phi c minus g times phi c plus a term of order phi tilde, which is h bar over 2 phi tilde times the second derivative of phi evaluated at the saddle point times phi tilde plus term of order 3 half. So you get a term which is a constant in term of phi tilde and the term which is quadratic. Okay. So now re-express z of g. So instead of integrating over phi tilde, integrate over this. You get z of g equal exponential of minus 1 over h bar s of phi c minus g times phi c. Get this out of the exponential. And I get a functional integral over d phi tilde. So I just make a change of variable here, a linear shift, times the integral of exponential of minus 1 over h bar, 1 half phi tilde the second derivative of the action evaluated at phi c times phi tilde plus negligible term for the h bar squared. So this is a Gaussian integral. So this is formally just the determinant of this operator divided by h bar, if you want, to the power minus 1/2. The result of the Gaussian integral of a quadratic form is the determinant of the quadratic form to the power minus 1/2. Okay, so, yes?
I'm confused with the factor of h bar. Didn't the factor of h bar cancel? 1 over h bar came from the original exponential.
Yeah, so in fact, you can forget about this. Yes, no, I'm sorry. Yes, yes, there was 1 over h bar, so you're right. Yes, sorry. Yes, so it cancels. It's just this determinant. So that's a pure number.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
The h bar on the line
above
cancels.
Yeah, this.
1 over h bar, right?
No, but this one is there. There is no h bar for, you know, from this. For
on the right, sorry.
For this term, which is a classical term, there is no h bar.
Yeah, on the right, in the integral.
Yes, yeah, sorry. Thanks. Yeah, sorry, I'm start to be tired. Okay, so it's time to. Okay, so now we have that z of g is given by this times this.
Oops.
So it's easy now to take the log. So now it's easy to take the log. Remember the definition of w of g. So from this, we get that w of g is just h bar times the log of this, so it's g times phi c, the saddle point, minus s phi c. Minus 1/2 with the factor h bar, because I multiply the log of z by h bar, times the log of this determinant, which is a trace of the log of the second derivative of phi evaluated by phi c. So I have a compact expression, simple compact expression for w of g. Okay. So now, since I have this compact simple expression, I can compute the background field. Because remember, phi c is a function of g.
So you can please explain how you got to w from partition function z?
I just take the definition that w of u is h bar times the log of z.
Okay.
So I take the log of this, which is h bar times the log of this is minus s plus g phi c. And the log of this determinant to the power minus 1/2, it's minus 1/2 the log of the determinant. So it's minus h bar divided by 2, trace log of the determinant.
And so over there in step 2, if we take a square root of h bar, expand by square root of h bar.
Well, the square root of h bar term has disappeared.
It's just definition.
Okay. Well, okay, so now let's just show that out of this expression, we can compute phi, the background field, var phi, because the background field is just the functional derivative of w, which is a function of g, respect to G. So, this is G. So you have to take the functional derivative of this when you take into account the fact that G, it depends explicitly of G. Explicitly. This term and implicitly through the fact that the phi c is a functional of g because it's a solution of this equation. But you can do the calculation, and I'm going to just give the result. The result is that when you do that, you find that, so it's some kind of lemma. Compute this, you find that the background field phi is equal to the saddle point, phi c, which is a function of g, plus a correction term of order h bar that I can write, but I'm not going to write it. You see, phi c depends on g, and the background field, background field phi depends on g, but at first order in h bar, it's equal to the saddle point. And that's, it shows that the background field for classical theory is just the minimum of the action. Okay. So. And once you have do that, you are almost done. Once you have this, so this lemma is important, and maybe I'll have time. If I have time, I will derive it tomorrow. It's easy. But out of this lemma, you can make the Legendre transform. Because you can write that gamma of phi is phi times g minus w of g. But w of g is here. So this is s of phi c. It's minus this. So it's s of phi c minus g phi c plus the background field times g. So you get plus phi minus bar phi minus phi c times g plus 1/2 trace log of second derivative of phi c with a factor h bar. And then, of course, you are going to have higher order term of order h bar 3^2. You see? And now, using this, you can show easily that this term is equal to the classical evaluation evaluated at phi plus term of order h bar squared. It's also an easy calculation. What you have to do is just to rewrite that change variable and write that phi c is the background field plus a correction. And you can see that in this expression, the first order term in the correction is zero. And this follows from this equation. And now, in this expression, you can replace the second derivative of phi c by the second derivative of the background phi plus term of order h bar. because phi c is equal to var phi plus term of order h bar. So if you expand it to first order of h bar, you get the term of order h bar, but there is already an h bar. So this gives a correction of order h bar squared. So you end up with the result that I stated, which is that the quantum effective action as a function of the background field is a classical action evaluated for the background field plus h bar over 2, the trace of the log of the operator, which is the second derivative of the classical action evaluated for the background field. And you can check, in fact, that the term of order h bar 3 half are not there anymore. And that's, so in fact, it's h bar squared. So you can, so you prove the theorem. So the two steps that I have not showed, but that are easy to show, is that this lemma and the fact that this is equal to this, which is quite straightforward. So you see that using those compact notation and functional integral allow to show this very nice compact expression. And next lecture, I'm going to show that how this works for phi 4. Okay, but I already was too long. One final remark, as Dan told you, I think, I have to be away, unfortunately, on next Monday and next Tuesday. So we decided to move the lectures. So there will be a lecture tomorrow morning, then a lecture on Thursday and Wednesday, no lecture on Monday and Tuesday, and another lecture on Wednesday. So the only question is, do you prefer for those lectures on Wednesday lecture at the usual time, 9:30, or do you prefer the slot, the next slot, where there will be no lecture? No. So you may take some time to think, or we can just, well, if we can, I can make just, I see, well, if you, there is, if it's mixed, you discuss, but if everybody prefers one solution, we can choose now. So who prefers lecture at 9:30? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. So that's 8. And who prefers lecture at the next one, next slot? 1, 2, 3. Okay, versus 3. Okay, so, well, some people didn't vote.
By 9:30, you mean 9?
Yes.
No. I'm sorry. I mean 10:45.
And the first lecture starts at 9.
Pardon?
9:30. The first lecture starts at 9, as opposed to 9:30.
Yeah. So I mean either. So I mean, I'm sorry. I wasn't. So Wednesday. Nine. Or 10:45. Okay, so let's vote again, because I was. So who prefer 9? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. 9? And who prefers 10:45? 1, 2, 3. Okay, so. So then I think we'll keep it at 9, okay? Well, I can change in the last minute. Well, not really. I will, if you really have some big discussion and change your mind, let me know by the afternoon so that I know when I should put my clock. Okay.